Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Mark. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is in Bangkok. Our speaker today is active in AA and active in his home group. It's my great honor and pleasure to introduce my sponsor, Clancy.
My name is Clancy Imslin, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, where's my script? Well, I won't be invited back here again. I'm glad to be here this morning. I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober, as I like to say. I've changed the schedule a little bit. I was supposed to talk this morning on where do we go from here, but that really should be at the end of the convention. And so I'm speaking this morning on a talk called, I call it Seconds and Inches, because it's designed for people who've been sober a while to think about, like me. You know, there seem to be types of alcoholics. We never talk about it much, but there's types of alcoholics. There seems to be a type of alcoholic who they drink and get in trouble, have a terrible time, and something happens that really threatens their security. Maybe they lose a job, or they lose a family, or somebody dies, and they quit, and they never drink again. I know several people like that who used to drink heavily and don't drink anymore. And they are the people for whom, when they became addicted physically to alcohol, they are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created. Now, you don't hear much about alcohol addiction, you hear about narcotic addiction. Alcoholic addiction is much more lethal than drug addiction. When you withdraw from drugs, drug addiction, you get very, very sick. In alcohol addiction, you withdraw and sometimes you die. You go to convulsions and smash your head. It's just terrible. And these are people to be medically withdrawn. And so they create these treatment centers and they take them off step by step and explain what happened. They understand the nature of their problem. They come out and they quit and they never drink again. There's a hospital up in Seattle called Schick Shadel, and they advertise, "We will cure your alcoholism in 30 days. And we laugh at that, but they've got a whole list of names on their wall of men who are sober. They got a lot of failures too. There's one back right down there. But that's because he wasn't that type of alcoholic to whom they cater. Then there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by the way you measure them. They drink and have trouble, have problems. And something happens that really threatens their security. They lose a job or a family or somebody dies. And they quit. But they always drink again. Always eventually drink again. And these same type of people come out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks. I've learned my lesson. I know the problem. But they always drink again. And these are the types of alcoholics that have baffled humanity for a long time. 4,000 years of written history. I don't know how long before that. These are the type of people that just... at one time they thought they must be possessed by devils. They put them to death after a while. And they flog them and send them away and lock them. And never could find an answer. They had all kinds of cures along the way. Pour drugs in your alcohol so you get sick. So you would, but all you have to do is try to find a drink that hasn't got any drugs in it. Then that's about all. It's a real bafflement. And there's never been an answer. And even when I was a little boy, I'm old, but I'm not 4,000 years old. When I was a little boy, although I didn't know and didn't care, there was still no treatment for this condition anywhere. Anywhere. In fact, most of us know that story where this fellowship started in 1930 in the midst of another big depression. There was a wealthy family in New York who had a son they were grooming to run their business. Everybody else was poor, but they had a big successful business. They had a lot of money. They had a son who seemed to be, he would be attacked by nerves. He got terribly nervous, seemed like. And when he got terribly nervous, he would drink a lot of alcohol and get drunk. And they couldn't understand that because it was so unlike him. So they decided, we're going to go all out and find an answer for Roland. So they contacted the best doctor in the world, as far as they could tell, and asked him to take the case. Now, a lot of people don't know this, but you'll know it. The first doctor they contacted was Dr. Freud. And Dr. Freud refused to take the case, which is the first break we ever got. We'd all be sitting here this morning saying, but I dreamt I was sober. So they went to his ex-colleague, Dr. Jung, and most of us know that story. They contacted him, said, yes, bring him to Switzerland, to my hospital. And so two guys took him over there and put him in the hospital, and Dr. Jung worked with him every day for a year to break down that psychic wall that was keeping him from finding peace. And he really worked with him. And after about a year, he said, Roland, you've come to this so well. You found a fruition. He said, you're all right now. Go back and God bless you. And he went back, and he and his friends stopped in Paris, some wealthy friends of his family, toasted his new success. And 3 days later, he was face down drunk in Paris. They couldn't imagine what the hell. He didn't have any nerves yet. He had, what's the matter? So they took him back to Dr. Jung and said, Dr. Fred Roland had a little lashback. And Dr. Jung said, I'm sorry, he can't come back in this hospital. Which sounded cruel, but it was a very lucky thing for us. And Roland said, people said, why not? Roland didn't mean any harm. He just somehow got sick again. He said, I understand that. I understand also that I had misdiagnosed his case. I thought certain he had deep-seated psychological problems I could help him with. But I see now that he is what is known as a chronic alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no effective treatment for that condition today in the world at any price. That was 1931, not all that long ago. And of course, Roland said, what does this mean, doctor? The doctor says, what it means is this. You must keep yourself confined voluntarily or involuntarily as long as you live. Otherwise, you almost certainly will intermittently drink to excess until you die or go mad. Kind of bad news to get. Roland says, is there no other possibility? He said, well, in the literature, I've read the literature, and I've seen a couple cases where there's been an involuntary psychological reversion. They call it some sort of a spiritual experience. He said, but I've never seen one, and I don't know anyone who's seen one. He says, I believe you have a better chance of being hit by lightning and having this involuntary psychological. So Roland came back to New York, and he didn't stop in Paris for dinner this time. But on the way back, he was terribly depressed. And on that ship, he did something that I guess we all have to do, although we don't know it. He somehow surrendered to the fact that he was helpless and hopeless. And he came back, and he'd been a vestryman in the Presbyterian Church. I mean, he was a nice guy, religious guy, and everything else. But he knew that he looked around, what can I do? And by a stroke of fate, just by a stroke of fate, that happened to be the top period of another organization. In the 1908, there was a Lutheran minister in Pennsylvania who felt that Christianity was getting out of hand. They're getting too slothful, too easygoing. But we need to be more like those people who are willing to be crucified for their faith, to be crucified upside down, to go through torture. So he started an organization called the First Century Christian Association to get Christians to believe more strongly. And of course, it didn't really draw a lot of people. And he had a few people who wanted to do it, but he went to England to try to talk it up in England after the First World War. And of all places, Oxford University, they just adopted it. Oh, what a wonderful idea. Great idea. We want to be vehement in our belief. Yeah, yeah. So vehement that they got to be known as the Oxford Group. And he came back in the 1920s and brought the Oxford Group back with a little social surroundings now. And so in the early 30s until about the mid-30s, the Oxford Group was a very, very big thing in the United States. Hadn't been before, wouldn't be afterwards. But in that period of time, and he thought, I'll go to the Oxford Group. What it really was it devolved to be pretty much well-to-do people meeting in each other's homes and talking about spiritual values, how to enhance their spiritual values. And he said, I'll go to the Oxford group, maybe I can stay sober a while. He wrote later, he said, I wanted to stay sober as long as I could so my parents would have a pleasant memory of me when I died drunk. And later on, when he died drunk, they had a pleasant memory of him. But he went to the Oxford group, and he got involved in it, and did well, I think, because of that surrender on the ship, because the Oxford group didn't keep anybody sober. And he loved it, and he did very well for it. Put him back in the business. 2 years later, he was running the business. Everybody was feeling good. And his parents were so excited by his new life. They said, Roland, you're doing so well. Why don't you take a vacation? Go up to our summer home you used to go to when you were young, up in Vermont. Go up there and spend a little while and enjoy yourself. He said, okay. So later on, look at that poor hunchback guy. Oh. While you're out there, ring the bells, will you? So he went up there. And the only interesting thing about this, if he had gone the next week, we wouldn't be here this morning. As AA is full of these kind of things. If he had gone the next week, we wouldn't be here. Because when he got there, arbitrarily, this one day, one of his friends came up and said, gee, Roland, good to see you. A childhood friend of ours who's now grown up, Ebby, he's a terrible drunk. And maybe you could talk to him. I know that you used to drink and you're sober now. Would you talk to him? He said, sure, I'm glad to talk to him. So he got him together with Ebby and said, Ebby, I can help you with some spiritual values that may help. I don't want to hear that crap. Don't give me that spiritual, religious crap. That doesn't work. I said, okay. About 4 days later, Ebby was drunk again and drove his car into somebody's house, outside of his house. And he arrested him, took him to jail. He was on strict probation. He's now going to go to the penitentiary. And the kid came back to Roland and said, Roland, please come and talk to the judge. The judge is my father, and he won't listen to me. But he'll listen to you because he knows your father so well. Would you come down to court and see what you can do? So he came down, as long as I'm here. He went down to court and said, you know, Judge, I used to drink and I'm sober now. And it helps. I'm in the Oxford group in New York. If you'd release him in my custody, I'll take him to New York. The judge says, all right. Only because it's you. I would do this for no one else, but I know your father. He said, you keep him out of Vermont. If he comes back here, he's going to the penitentiary. Take him to New York. So Roland took Ebby back to New York and stuck him in a mission on Lower Broadway and got him involved in the Oxford group. And Ebby was so glad not to go to prison that he really just played along with the whole game, you know, and did well. And after about 4 months, Roland came to Ebby and said, now, what do we do in the Oxford group? Once we get our legs on the ground, we find someone and testify to him. Roland said, I don't want to testify, Ebby said. It's embarrassing enough to be in the organization without testifying. He said, well, you want to go back to Vermont? He said, no, I believe I'll testify. He thought, who could I testify to? He didn't want to be embarrassed and testify to people that might think highly of him, if there were any. But he happened to remember this drunken puke that he used to run around with when he was a kid. He was now in New York, couldn't hold a job, living off his wife, a big mooch, had a reputation of mooch. He thought, if I can get a hold of this idiot, I'll testify to him. He won't even remember it. You know, he'd go. So he located this Bill Wilson and made arrangements to see him. Now, in our big book, Bill talks about how he came to the door and Ebby looked so sharp and clean. And he said, gee, Ebby, you look great. I found religion, he said. And Bill, that turned him off. But there's more to that story than that. I heard Ebby talk many years ago at the International Convention, 1960. And he said that he went in, they sat down, and he tried to tell Bill about the Oxford group, and Bill just drank as fast as he could. Happy days, Roland. Ebby, that's doing. And so Ebby left, and he was a little pissed by this. You know, who wants to be outsmarted by a drunk? So he came back about 3 days later, and he had the Oxford group closer with him. You know, I just want to tell you about the Oxford group. And Bill got drunker than ever. That's all. But a few days later, he was feeling guilty and remorseful. He said, I'm going to go over to that mission, and I'm going to see what Abby's got. And he had a few drinks on the way, then a few more, and then a few more. By the time he got to the mission, he was drunk. Abby wasn't there, but he gave a short sermon anyway, just to be on the safe side. Stangered out down the street, this drunken mooch, and wound up at the hospital again, where he always wound up. This time it was a little different. The doctor called his wife and said, Mrs. Wilson, I'd hate to tell you this, but this may be the last time your husband will drink like this. He doesn't have any left in him. He's going to die. And she said, oh, my God. She called up the mission. Abby, would you please go over there and talk to Bill? He might die. So Abby got a couple of guys from the mission. They went up there and talked to him. And Christ said, Bill, you got to find some power greater than yourself. You got to find a God to turn your life over. You got to surrender somehow. I don't want to hear that crap. I didn't think I'd get religion from you, Abby. Get out of here. And they went home. And that drunken mooch with nothing to qualify him for anything other than a drunkard's death turned out to have one of those spiritual experiences that nobody ever had. He wrote later, he said, in the middle of the night he woke up so lost. God, if you're there, show yourself, God. He started to cry, and all of a sudden the room lit up, he said. And it seemed like there was a wind blowing through the room. He thought, I'm going insane. I'm going insane. And then it went away again. He felt different. The morning he told the doctor, Doctor, does this mean that I'm insane? And the doctor looked him in the eye and says, no, Bill, I don't know. I don't know what it is, but you look different. Whatever you got, hang on to it. And he came out of that hospital, and he associated this. He went to the Oxford group, trying to find how to keep it going. Now you think, well, what's all the deal about Abby and Roland and all that? Maybe you just had it anyway. Maybe. But the very few people that had these things always associated him with religion and went to church work. He associated it with stopping drinking for people and went to the Oxford group to help people stop drinking. And he went to the Oxford group for months, and he was so excited, he got involved in it. And, he would bring drinkers to the meeting and see if they could get him sober. And, I mean, he was picking up street drunks, bad street drunks, and into these nice upper-class people. I believe you're vomiting on my shoe, sir. And sometimes he'd take them home when they were really dire case, and nobody ever stayed sober for him. He'd preach to them and give them sermons. And one morning, Bill got up after about 6 months of this, and he noticed the guy he'd brought home the night before had left and taken some stuff out of the kitchen, apparently to sell for wine. And he looked at his wife, who'd been this pert little society girl when he met her. She was old before her time now, her hair turning gray, putting on her cheap sweater with a patch on the arm to go off and work in some cheap department store. And he said, Lois, I'm sorry. I want to apologize. You've been supporting me for months, and I thought I could help people. I thought I had the experience to help me help people, but I realized now it was a psychosis. That's all it was. He said, I'm going to stop doing this. I'm going to get a job somehow, and I'm going to take care of you. I've been working with people for 6 months, and not one person has stayed sober, and to hell with it. And right then, your life and mine hung by a thin thread. And she turned to him and said something that echoed down in history. I was having lunch with her many years ago in Connecticut. I said, Lois, how did you ever think of that answer? God, it was a great answer. She said, I don't know, it just seemed so obvious. He didn't seem to think about it. What he said, not one person has stayed sober. And she said, you did. Oh, yeah. That's why old timers don't have much hair in front. You just go through. So he kept trying, and oddly enough, a month later, somebody came to him and said, Bill, I got a deal for you. The word's out that you're not drinking anymore. We got this deal in Akron. We're going to put together this company. If we can get the votes, the proxies, I'm going to send you out there, and you can be president of the company. You got to get it working, though, because if you fail, don't come back asking for any more help again, because that means you're just a loser. So go out there. Your life depends on getting this deal together, so go out there. And Bill was excited. He went to Akron, Ohio, and started going on it, and the whole deal blew up in his face. Blew up in his face. And, oh, God, my one chance. And he stood in the lobby of the hotel on a hot May morning, and reached in his pocket. He had $10. He could either pay his hotel bill or he could take the train home. And he said, yeah, what am I going to do? And I stood in that very lobby where he stood. I tried to recreate it, got kind of a sense of romantic or something. But over where there was a door over here, there was a curved little sign over it that said cocktails in orange neon. And as he saw that, and as he wrote later, he said, I knew if I just have one or two drinks, I could think of an answer to this. And he started towards that bar. And I'll tell you, we were almost dead. Because just out of the corner of his eye, he saw some telephones over there. And in small town hotels, they used to have banks of telephones. And over they had all the churches with the ministers' names and numbers. And he remembered he'd promised his friends in New York at the Oxford Group that he would call an Oxford member before he drank. So he went over to the phones and took out a nickel, called up the first one on the list. Says, my name is Bill Wilson. I'm a rum hound from New York. I need to talk to somebody in the Oxford Group. And the minister said, I don't know what your problem is, sir, but I'm trying to write a sermon. Don't bother me. And hung up. And the next guy wasn't in. And the next guy wasn't in. And the next guy said, I don't know, I can't help you. I'm sorry. And I don't know about you, but I suspect guys like me would think, well, I did what I said I could. I did what I said I would. I'll just have maybe just a couple drinks. And boy, our lives were almost over. And at the bottom of the list, there's a funny name. He thought, Reverend Walter Tunk. I should call Reverend Walter Tunk, for Christ's sake. So he called Reverend Walter Tunk. He said, I'm a rum hound from New York, and I'm looking for somebody in Oxford. And the minister said, funny you should call. I have a very good parishioner who told me just that this week her doctor said that he was a member of the Oxford Group, but he said he was an alcoholic. Why don't you stay there and see if I can get you together? So Bill stood in the telephone booth, hot day. Thank God all the calls went through because he was going to wait long. And he called the lady, and the lady called her doctor's family. And the doctor's wife said, well, the doctor can't come. He's drunk on the floor. I can't get him up. And said, well, we'll come out tomorrow, though. So she called back to the lady, and the lady got the phone number back from Reverend Tunk and called up Bill, and Bill was just about to blow out and got the phone. And she gave him instructions how to catch a streetcar out to her house the next day. Turned out to be Mother's Day. And so he went out there, and Dr. Bob, so sick, and his wife, so angry, and so their two kids, they had to bring him along because Bob was too drunk to drive, too sick to drive. The young guy, 16, young Bob, they called him, an old friend of mine. I knew him quite well. He died a couple years ago, but he described that trip so well. He said, I was driving my car, and all I could hear was my dad in the back seat saying to my mom, Ann, he says, I'll talk to this guy because I've spoiled your Mother's Day. But I'm not going to sit there and listen to some damn lecture about my drinking. I'm sick of lectures about my drinking. I'll give him 15 minutes and then I'm getting out of there. And they got there. The two guys met. And after a while, the failure from New York said, let's go to this room and chat for a while. So I went in. And they were there for 4 hours. And they came out and Bob said to his wife, Ann, I don't know how to tell you this, but that's the first guy that seems to know how I feel, that know why I drink. I can't believe this. And he said to Bill, I know you're going to get back to New York, but could you stay with us just a little while? We could talk a little bit more, maybe a few weeks. And Bill thinking, let's see, I have no way to get out of town. Yes, I can stay. So they spent a couple of weeks discussing the spiritual values and how to stay sober through spiritual surrender. And the doctor just blossomed. After 2 weeks, he said, Bill, I never dreamed I could feel like this. Last year, I was at the American Medical Association convention. I was so drunk that they all ridiculed me and made fun of me. Now I'm going to go this year, and I'm going to show them what's happened to me. You stay here with my wife and kids, and I'm going to Atlantic City, and I'll be back Monday, and I'm going to have a life. And early Monday morning, the phone rang. Mrs. Smith answered. The woman on the phone said, Oh, Mrs. Smith, I'm so sorry. This is Dr. Bob's office nurse. They called me from the station this morning. They carried him off the train so drunk he couldn't walk. And the station agent called me, and I've got him here at the office. Cab driver brought us here. He's laying on the floor, and he's so sick, and I'm so sorry. I know he was doing better, and I'm so sorry. Uh-oh. So Bill and Mrs. Smith went down to the office, got this drunk. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to. It's kind of funny, but it isn't funny. It's lethal is what it is. They brought him home and put him to bed. He cried and whined and just all the sickening. And finally went to sleep. Wednesday morning. He said, What day is it? He says, Wednesday, Bob. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I got to do a cancer surgery today, and I can't do a cancer surgery. They'll take my license if I postpone it again. I postponed it before. God, what am I going to do? So his new friend Bill and his wife got him up and bathed him. Bill bought him some booze to stop his hand from shaking. And away he went in his car to the hospital. He said, I'll be home at 1 o'clock. I can do the surgery pretty well. And at 1 o'clock, he wasn't home. And at 2 o'clock, and 3 o'clock, and 4 o'clock, and 5 o'clock. Yeah, we knew. Son of a bitch is drunk again. He's out on a run. All of a sudden, at 6 o'clock, the car pulled up. And he sprung in the house and said, Boy, do I feel great. He said, Where you been, Bob? He said, Well, I was doing that surgery. I was thinking about, the Oxford group says that everybody should make amends. I never thought doctors should have to make amends. But I realized I'm a human being, too. And I spent all afternoon making amends to all the people I could think of that I hurt in Akron. He said, I just feel wonderful. That was June 10th, 1935. And we consider that the birthday of our fellowship. Although they didn't know it was the birthday of a fellowship. But they realized that sitting talking about spiritual matters had not kept Bob sober. And it hadn't kept Bill sober. What it kept Bill sober was trying to help people. So they found some drunk up in the hospital through a friend, through a nun that the doctor knew, Sister Ignatia. And they went to his wife, this drunk's wife. He was a lawyer from Louisville who had moved to Akron to get sober and got drunker, that's all. And so they went to his wife, and she went into her husband. She said, Bill, his name was Bill, too. Said, Bill, there are two fellows who want to talk to you about your drinking. She said, I don't want to talk to anybody about my drinking. I'm sick of talking to people about men drinking. I just get sick of their preaching. But as he said, I heard him describe it in his talk. He said, but my wife's a strong woman. I talked to those two men. And they never talked to me about my drinking once. They talked about their drinking and how they felt. And I never heard anybody describe me before. And I was so impressed, I stuck with him. I've been with him ever since. Number three. Then they tried to work with a couple of people around town to get him in the Oxford group. They didn't want to hear this crap. And tried to. They got a young guy in. Just a quick little anecdote. He was 29. His name was Ernie. And they thought maybe he's too young to be an alcoholic because Bill was just turned 40 and Dr. Bob was at 50. But he got involved with him, talked to people. He stayed sober, did well. And he fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter, which sounds beautiful, except he did something that we should always curse him for. He brought the first relationship to our fellowship. I don't know any word that sends a cold chill down a sponsor's spine like that one. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. Oh, shit. You have to have a little machine on your phone that says, uh-huh, uh-huh, put the phone on. I know I thought the last one was, but God, I'll tell you, when I saw her walking out of detox this morning, I just... But they fell in love and they got married. And that's suddenly a romantic thing, doesn't it? That happened in my family. My youngest daughter, Susie, married a man who I sponsored, but several years. I wasn't in favor of the marriage, but what do fathers know? You know. So I went, my daughter married this guy, and I'll tell you the clinical description of mixed emotions. Watching your daughter go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. Oh, Jesus. You can't really say anything, but you can give hints, you know.
Let me know if he ever brings a sheep home, honey.
So anyway, these two got married, and they said, gee, Ernie, you got to take care of your new wife now for a while. We'll take care of all this running around the Oxford group stuff. You just stay home and take care of your wife. He said, okay. And they were surprised when he got drunk and died and turned her against AA for 50 years. But they continued. Pretty soon they had a few little group people going. Not sober people. They're all members of the Oxford group. It was called the drinker's wing of the Oxford group. And the Oxford group were getting a little tired of it because all these guys ever want to do is talk about their drinking. And the Oxford group want to talk about their spiritual growth. And so Bill went back to New York finally and got some people back there. And Dr. Bob had this little thing going in Akron. And they stumbled forward little by little. A couple of years, they had a few people going. And then they decided, what do we really need to do? The hospital's given such a bunch of crap. We can't get people in there. You have to say they got diverticulitis or something. If we had a hospital of our own, we could help alcoholics. They'd come from all over and we could help. But how are we going to get the money to write to build a hospital? We'll write a book. We'll write a book about our experiences. Bill, you can do that. And they'll sell a lot of them and we'll build a hospital. So Bill, over a period of a couple of months, wrote a book that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. And they got it done and sent postcards to every doctor in the East. They got two orders. Only half the people within the organization bought one. And so they realized that wasn't going to work. But at least they had a book. And then Mrs. Smith's cousin worked for John Rockefeller. Maybe get some money through that, because he liked what they were doing. And John, they had the dinners we all know about, and he said, money will spoil your organization. But what most people don't know is that he did slip Bill Wilson $10,000 so that Dr. Bob would not be evicted from his home in Akron and Bill could pay for his rent, because they were really up against it. In 1939, Liberty Magazine, which was a little magazine at that time, wrote an article about this new thing that they had. They had now called it Alcoholics Anonymous, named after their book, and made it sound like a religion. It had no, just people were going, stopped going, you know. And then in 1940, Saturday Evening Post had a guy who specialized in uncovering corruption. He had just written a stinging series of articles on that Philadelphia waterfront labor movement, corrupt. Next job, work into this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous and blow the whistle on these people. So he did. And he got in there, went to St. Louis, where there's a chapter, and went to Chicago and Akron, New York, and he couldn't believe it. Jesus, they're doing what they say they're doing. No one's getting any money out of this. They're doing it out of helping one another. I can't believe it. He was stunned. And he sat down and wrote this article for the Reader's Digest, for the Saturday Evening Post, most of our family were knowing about it, which appeared in the first week of March of 1941. And for the first time ever, there was a national announcement to people all over the country. If you have a drunkard in your family that refuses to stay sober, there's now a way to get him sober. And they were just flooded by mail. All over, flooded by mail. And they'd send him a book, and they'd send him some little things about what AA was about, and there were chapters formed everywhere. Montana and Wyoming and big cities and small all over. By 1942, AA was booming, just booming. Then 1943, of course, the war was on, but Bill started getting letters saying, you know, we're having a little problem here. The guys are losing interest, and they're fighting amongst themselves. And our group is dying, so take us off your mailing list. By 1944, it got to be a lot of groups dying. By early 1945, Bill had the sense this is all going to become extinct. Maybe New York and Akron will stay, but I don't think anybody else will. So he wanted to try to unify people. So he started a magazine, called it The Grapevine. Not the way we see it now, but in a tabloid form. And that helped a little bit, but it helped a lot. And AA was on the way out. And a guy, a doctor in North Carolina, wrote an article for The Grapevine and sent it into Bill and said, Bill, I don't know if you know these facts, this is interesting. And he wrote it, and Bill read this article and found out there had been an organization just like AA almost exactly 100 years before, that six old drunks sat in a bar in Baltimore. One was just out of jail. And he came home and said to Mr. Fred, you know, that chaplain down there said that he knew how I felt. He didn't know how I feel. You guys are the only guys who know how I feel, and you're just as bad off as I am. They said, well, maybe we could help each other not drink. Well, how could you? Well, so they drew up a little constitution. They elected officers, five officers and one member. Who do you identify with? And they tried to help each other. When one wanted to drink, the other five would get together with them and work. And they got a few people to come, and people were laughing. You know, you bums can't keep yourself sober. You're going to keep each other sober? For Christ's sake, stop it. But some guys came down from Philadelphia to see what was going on, and they went back, started a group in Washington. And they named it, they said, there's never been a group like ours before of drunks helping drunks, like America, the first of its kind. So we're going to name ourselves after George Washington. We'll be the Washingtonian movement. And we started in March, but we'll take his birthday. February 22nd is our anniversary. And so some people came from Boston. That really took off up there in New York. At the end of the year, they had several hundred people staying sober, all helping each other. By the end of the second year, most of the states had them. But people still thought they were a bunch of weirdos. You know, what are these drunks? So what they did, they got to all the chapters they could reach with the mail, and said, on our birthday, on February 22nd, 1842, have somebody from your community, someone who's a young guy on the way up, and have him give us a talk. We don't care what he says. We don't pay attention to what he says. But we want him to say that we're not crazy people. We're people really trying to do something good. So all over the country that day, people came in. In Springfield, Illinois, they had a young lawyer named Abraham Lincoln come in and talk to him. If you ever read a book of his speeches, there's one to the Washingtonians, February 22nd, 1842. And he gave talks in those days were long and boilerplate, a lot of it. But his last page or so, he said, as I look around this room, I see you men, and I know you all from Springfield. I know you're honest, good men. And I've never been able to understand your thirst. I don't have that thirst. And I'm so glad that you're able to control it at last. And it continued to grow. And entertainment in those days was consist of mass meetings. They'd bring a famous speaker in or an entertainer of some sort, and there's no TV, no radio, no nothing. That's mass meetings were how they got entertained. And they got a couple of these speakers sobered up and in their organization, and they've been talking it up, and they just started to flock into the Oxford group, I mean to the Washingtonians. By 1845, it was estimated they had 100,000 sober drunks. Now, this may not impress you, but AA, after 5 years, didn't have 1,000, and they had radio and newspaper articles, everything. And then the leaders of the Washingtonian movement got together and decided on something, which seems right because people at AA think about it today. If we can help drunkards, we should be able to help a lot of other people too. Maybe we should help people who have narcotic problems who are not drunkards, not cocaine and heroin today, but like laudanum and opium, which they used then. Maybe we should get involved with people who are emotionally unfit and help them. Maybe some of us should get involved in helping Texas become a state, because it's getting a lot of war over it. Maybe we should try to work in the anti-slavery movement. And they all just got involved in things that just helping the world and helping America, and this whole group of enthusiastic people. And by 1848, the Washingtonians were extinct, and nearly all of them died drunk. I have a book home written in 1861 by one of the survivors. He said, I don't know, I can't tell you what happened. We were doing so well. We were helping so many people that after a while, I got so old, the person who was drunk came. We didn't have time for him anymore. And one by one, the people dropped by the wayside. And I'm one of the very few left. And I'll tell you how extinct they became. Bill Wilson had never heard of them 100 years later, the most successful anti-drinking organization in the world at that time. And he read that, and he read the problems they had. They fought amongst themselves in this Washingtonian movement. These famous speakers got fighting over who got the most publicity in the press, who could make more money by helping people, a lot of things. And he realized, God, we have some of those same problems. What can I do? And he sat down in 1945, and in a last gasp effort to save AA, wrote the 12 Traditions. We could, you know, if you're new, you think sometimes, well, they were there all along. They weren't there. That's based on thousands of people dying. And he wrote them not in the form that we read them in the condensed form, but in the long form. If you haven't read them, they're in the back of the book, across from the short form. In our book, in our meeting in Los Angeles, we read the long form once a month so that new people understand what they're about. We read the short form the other weeks. But he introduced these traditions, one by one, in his new grapevine. And AA had a problem then that it has now. We don't know how to overcome it. It's full of alcoholics. Jesus. People, we don't want to hear about the goddamn traditions. We're here for love. And people send in letters saying, I want to cancel my subscription for Christ. I don't want to read that crap. I mean, really was. And Bill would hop on his motorcycle, stick his wife in the sidecar, drive to meetings, try to explain it all over the East Coast. And some believed him, some didn't. And they just had a terrible time with it. And they realized somehow we've got to get the message out to these people. We've got to get a message out to these people somehow, but how can we do it? And as was possible, as you might suspect, the AA group in Akron and their followers didn't like the new AA group in New York. The people in Akron were stuck more with the Oxford group, but they had the four absolutes, honesty, unwilling, so on. And the people in New York didn't have that. In fact, Bill stayed away from when he wrote the book. He said, none of us have any chance of ever doing it perfectly. And so Bill and Dr. Bob, they always got along well together. They said to their followers, let's see if we can just set up a meeting somewhere and explain these traditions before we die. And the people in Akron said, well, we'll go to a meeting. We won't go to New York. People in New York, not to be outdone in spirituality, said, we'll go to a meeting. We won't go to Akron. So Bill and Dr. Bob got together in Cleveland. Okay. So they all showed up in Cleveland in July of 1959, at least representatives from all the various groups that still survived, from Los Angeles and from San Francisco and from Chicago and from Helena, Montana and Miami and Houston and so on. And that's a one-time meeting to try to convince them on the steps. And even then, after all this, they still weren't sure. They're kind of like the Oxford group. They weren't sure that, like the Washingtonians, they weren't quite sure they were being accepted. So most of the speakers at that first meeting, convention, were non-alcoholics. The warden of San Quentin talks and people from social services talk, because they're trying to so convince people we're really legitimate. But among other things, Dr. Bob and Bill talked at that meeting. I have the tapes of this at convention, kind of bad quality, but great tapes. And Dr. Bob was dying of cancer. And they said, you probably don't want to talk, Bob. He said, well, I've got to talk. I've got 15 years. That's the second longest sobriety in the world. So on that day, his son on one side, a man, tall, gaunt, dying man, brought him to the podium, and he gave a very touching talk. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard it or read it. He said, I want to welcome you all to Cleveland. I hope you go back and tell the boys and girls in your group that we're all doing the same thing. We get out of AA, what we put into it, we've all done the same things. We all get the same results. He said, as I look over this group, I'm happy that some small thing I did 15 years ago helped bring this about. I'm so pleased. He said, I want to apologize for my health. I've been in bed most of the past few months, and my health hasn't returned the way I hoped it would. It's just, you know, just usual stuff. But then, he said, I would be remiss if I didn't call your attention to two or three things that I think to be of interest. And then he gave what many people conceive to be the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because he was the great communicator, much more than Bill. And this was almost like a deathbed, not a confession, but an admonition. And he said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but have nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like it who doesn't know exactly what he's talking about. We all are wonderful when things are going our way. Love is the answer, baby. Ha, 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 doing well, baby. But just let somebody hurt our feelings. I don't even think that son of a bitch is an alcoholic. And finally he said, none of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to maybe explain things to us, to take us to a few meetings, give us a pat on the back when we desperately needed it. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency when we don't have time to help our fellow who still suffers in this blackness of alcoholic despair. He said, thank you, sat down, was dead shortly after. And that is what he said there is true today in Thailand as it was in Cleveland. I mean, and Bill gave a talk later, and they had six young guys introduced to traditions. Each took two traditions of the long form and explained it. And they said, I know some of you think these are rules, but they're not rules. These are suggestions to save AA. He said, we don't have any AA police. These are suggestions. And I remember hearing that phrase and thinking, that may have been a mistake. Now, in my hometown, although it's unfair, I have a reputation of being a dictator-type sponsor. I share rather strongly, I guess. But people always forget, to be a dictator-type sponsor requires 100% approval of the dictatee. All he has to say is, screw you, and the dictatorship is over. And I think it would be nice if we had AA police could come at night and say, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp. But they read these traditions, and I don't know who they were, don't know their names, but I could just hear their tails wagging, just the enthusiastic. And then Bill got up and they were done, and he still didn't think he'd get a vote, I guess. He said, you've heard the traditions read. Seeing no objections, we accept them. You know, I'll tell you a funny little anecdote about that. We forget that. We like to make these people saints and so on. But what Bill Wilson did from after that was speak on Friday night. That thing went so well, they decided to have another meeting 5 years from then. And they had another one in St. Louis. And that went so well, they started another one in 5 years, which is where international conventions came from. But Bill Wilson always spoke on Friday night. In 1970, we were at the international convention. I heard him speak in 1960 in Long Beach, in 1965 in Toronto. In 1970, God, we were in this big Miami Beach, this big convention center. Friday night, people just... You could cut the excitement with a knife. Oh, Bill's going to talk. And just as the meeting started, somebody walked out and said, "We're very sorry, but Bill is severely ill, too ill to talk tonight." And God just, oh. We didn't know that he was dying of emphysema. What was that about? And he said, "But we have a substitute who's going to fill in." Screw you. And on the way, I was walking back to the hotel with a guy named John, a friend of mine from Pittsburgh, who got sober under Dr. Baum. I said, "Isn't that too bad, John? We'll never hear Bill talk again. They say he's on the edge of death." He said, "Oh, he'll talk at this convention." I said, "He won't talk. I talked to the people from the New York office. He's not going to talk." He said, "I just got a feeling he'll talk." So I thought, well, maybe he knows something I don't know. So Saturday night, big meeting. Didn't talk then. Last big meeting was Sunday morning. The regularly scheduled guy came out and gave a talk. No Bill Wilson. About halfway through his talk, a guy came out and said, "I have some wonderful news. An ambulance has just brought Bill Wilson to the back door." And they wheeled him in, tubes out of him, all going over, dying man. And he pulled himself up to the... "I am so happy to be here. I know we will long, as long as we're doing God's will." And it sounded like the tape broke when you hear the tape. Oh. But he ran out of wind. And they chaired and they whipped him off back to the ambulance and away he went. And as we were walking back to the hotel to get him, John, I said, "John, how the hell did you know Bill was going to talk? Nobody knew he was going to talk. How do you know?" He said, "Kid, you got to remember, around here you're dealing with human beings. They might be inspired human beings, but they're human beings. Do you think Bill Wilson would want it said that Dr. Bob talked while he was dying and Bill did?" And so the introduction of the traditions in 1950 and their gradual introduction and the gradual growth of AA. And I came to AA, when I came to AA in 1958, Bill Wilson had only 23 years, but at that time we thought, no one will ever reach that much time again. That's like over the hill and far away. But, you know, not today, 23 years is not that big a deal. But it was then. But little by little, the thing that always touched me about Alcoholics Anonymous, there are even more things than I talked about. I kind of hit the highlights today. But there were time after time, something had to happen just right. Just miss a day. Just miss a contact. Miss a phone call. And we're all drunk. It's just remarkable that we are here. And sometimes we fail to remember how to be grateful for our sobriety because things aren't working out in our life. Maybe I didn't get my raise or somebody treating me badly. But we're human beings, so we're never going to stay grateful. But every so often we got to grab ourselves by the back of the neck and say, Jesus, I'm glad I'm sober. Because by any luck of the draw, we shouldn't be. Some of us should be dead, and some of us should be institutionalized, and some of us should just be messes at home. As a result of that, some seconds and inches and people to game together, and we have a chance to live. Thank you.
Thank you. Let us now close the meeting with the Serenity Prayer, using the word God as you've come to understand him. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom.